This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate Gee. I've created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk analyze and explain the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many, many more. A new episode comes out every other Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And if you'd like to call in and leave a voicemail question or comment to be read on the show, the U.S. number is 714-900-2601. Or send it in through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org. All right, good evening, everybody. It's Nate Gee here, along with Dr. Jen Hawk and Dr. Doug Lyle. We have you both together in one show. How are you both doing?
Good. All's well.
Pretty well. Yeah. I've been hearing a lot of questions about the last show. Several people have mentioned that you said something about solving the romance problem, and people are like, "Sign me up. How do I do it? What's going on?" So I don't know what happened. I haven't listened to the show, but it sounds like
must have been
most definitely
big
wasn't me. It was
made.
Dr. Lyle and you. So.
Yep, it must have been alluding to yours and my solution for this thing later, Jen.
I know that's what you're alluding to. I just don't know quite what you said.
Yeah, I didn't say much.
That's all he said.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, people are very interested.
Yes, they should be, but that's all right. We'll get to it.
Yeah. It's what we in the business call a teaser. Is that what it is?
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, it's not like we haven't been teased for like 3 or 4 years now.
It's true. Yeah, this is a timeline to answer the most common question. People are like, when is this? When is this happening? It's a timeline that is totally out of our control. So the book's timeline is in our control. We're just delinquent.
Yeah.
But this timeline is very much out of our control.
Exactly. That's it.
So that's all we'll say
that's
about
all we're
that.
Say. All good.
All right. We'll remain in the dark.
You got it.
All right. Well, how have you been doing, Dr. Hawk? I understand you've had some time to take off from the show, I guess. So what have you been up to?
Farming, building the little micro farm. It's pawpaw season around here, so I've been harvesting pawpaws like crazy, which is this sort of native North American fruit that is like a tropical fruit that grows all over the place. Here where I am in Virginia and all over this region. So if people have not experienced the pawpaw, they are missing out. It is it's like a mango banana cross almost. It's people describe it in a lot of different ways, but it's like a soft chirimoya like banana apple.
Does Dr. Greger
it's
have
a
video on it?
Very I don't know if he has a video on it. I know it's his favorite, his very favorite fruit in the world. It's delicious. I had never had it before. It's super fragile, so it does not transport very well, and it's you can maybe find it at a local farmer's market, but if you can find it in the wild, that's the best way to get it. Go out on a hike and find a pawpaw grove. And it's only ripe for a very short window of time, usually right around now in September. So I've just been out there in the forest every day gathering up pawpaws.
Well, that sounds like fun. Well, that's where you were all these weeks.
Exactly. I'm very busy with my tropical fruit gathering.
And how's that whole life?
It's awesome.
Yeah. All good.
Yeah. Highly recommended.
All right.
I'm seed saving, so I'll have little pawpaw trees next year for people who want one.
Well, I mean, it sounds like, how can you say no?
Yeah.
Exactly.
All good?
All right.
Well, what else we got?
Dr. Lyle, what do you say? What else we got? How about we get to some questions?
Thank God.
Dr. Hawk, stop chit-chatting.
Hey, you asked. I was ready to just get down to questions and no chit chat, and you're the one who started this process.
No,
it's
I'm
your
gonna,
fault.
I'm just blame you for whatever reason, whether it makes sense or not.
Patriarchy.
That's it.
Patriarchy. Toxic masculinity at work again.
Oh, your alarm's out of batteries, so you know we're good.
That's it.
Yeah.
All right, Nathan, what do we got?
Okay, so our first question sounds deep, but maybe the answer won't be as deep. Let's try and find out. Dear doctors, how does evolutionary psychology approach the complex human need to understand how, why, when about the workings of the universe?
What the human and other animals have is they have an instinct to learn. And the reason why they would have an instinct to learn is that they have embedded in the brain algorithms for running cost-benefit analysis on the acquisition of information. So if you're walking in the woods at night, you might have been like literally on the cusp of the universal grand unified field theory in physics. But if a twig snaps 30 feet away, you're going to stop that thinking immediately and turn your head to the left and see what on earth it is. Because if you don't do that, that may be the last moment of your existence. So your brain is incessantly curious for what it is that it that are within the range of its interests. And that means it's inherently curious about the context that it finds itself in. And so, for example, the workings of the universe, it would make sense for us to understand, you know, where you come from, what the timelines are, what are the forces that could have made it, what are the periodicity of those forces, et cetera, et cetera. So therefore, what the human being is going to have is potentially a pretty wide range of interests. And if you will, then there's going to be evolutionary currency involved with being able to display knowledge of whatever those things are, even if you can't see any practical reason why we would worry about whether there's moons around Alpha Centauri. But some young lady somewhere may be impressed by some guide that can tell her a story about it. And so therefore, that the display of the acquisition of information is itself a fitness indicator and therefore has immediate evolutionary consequences. So we don't need to look too deep for the reasons for human beings' curiosity and to understand the universe. The truth is that all animals have intense curiosity about anything that that they're running cost-benefit parameter estimations on in order to figure out what's in their best interest. That includes humans. And because that's true, the human relationships to a landscape and the ability of people to utilize materials around them and also to imagine future scenarios that could be good or ill, this would create a tremendous amount of curiosity and investigative energy inside of people for trying to figure out the universe that surrounds them. On top of that, because that would be true and your abilities in those areas would be significantly associated with your ability to survive and reproduce, the ability itself, i.e. the mental ability itself to actually turn itself to problems and to analyze and to come up with possible causal explanations itself would be a fitness indicator and therefore be selected by sexual selection. So I think we're done. I don't think we need any other great deep reasoning to try to figure out why human beings have an incessant curiosity in the universe. I think by the time we look at the immediate survival and reproductive problems in terms of your ability to understand the world around you, and then we add to that the fitness indicator aspects of that, that would have been very important for human beings to be paying attention to the intelligence and capability and knowledge of other people and order to, in mating with those individuals that have a little bit more gray matter than the ones that have a little bit less, that would then that would be sexually selecting these sort of curious characteristics. So I think that solves it.
Yeah. Are you implying there are differences between socially constructed or socially relevant groups? You know you can't make those kinds of implications in human behavior journals.
That's all right. Jen, you and I have opted out of journals for the rest of our lives. It's self-published books and seminars and webinars. Forget it. Everything else, the academia can pound sand. They have abdicated the search of the truth.
Yeah, we had the, I don't think we had the conversation here, but we had it on our Living Wisdom Library group a few weeks ago, where we were talking about the new submission guidelines for nature human behavior, where you're not allowed to make observations that might speak to any sort of differences or estimates of superiority or inferiority among socially constructed or socially relevant. Those are the terms of art groups, which of course rules out any of these natural selection or sexual selection processes that you're talking about, whether they have to do with curiosity about the world and intellectual show-offmanship or any of this. So yeah, those would be socially relevant categories, and we can't be valorizing those. So
what a tragedy.
I'd have a little dig.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the only other thing I would add to this, too, is that I think EP is useful as well for making sense of why some people don't have a very deep, innate need to understand the workings of the universe. I mean, certainly some people do, and the species as a whole does.
Right.
But you're just as likely to run into people who are very, you know, don't worry, be happy, just live in the moment. You know, I don't have any sort of interest or concern about how it all works or what it's all about.
Right.
And it helps us understand what's going on with those individuals, just like it helps us understand the other individuals. So,
yeah. Fascinating. That's great, Jen. Yeah. And there would be
a whole other set of fitness signals.
Yeah. Just in the same.
Well, they,
yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, these are just individuals who have come through a different genetic adaptive process of fitness indicators. So they are not displaying their fitness in the way that Doug is describing. They're displaying their fitness through literal acts of physical fitness or courage or dance or performance, or, you know, there's a million different ways that
flirting.
Women show off for each other. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It? So flirting.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. So if you have a competitive advantage in one of those domains relative to your intellectual seeking or your philosophical questing or your ability to explain what it is that you're looking at in the night sky or you know, how the spheres spin, etc., then you're going to lean into that competitive advantage, and so shall your future generations. So it's just individual variation.
Yeah, absolutely.
Wow. Okay. Now, Dr. Hawk, as a political, you know, scientist, I was going to say operative, but that's too much. I've been watching too many spy shows. But
yeah, not anymore. I used to be.
But as a political scientist, does this kind of imply that if a population is too busy trying to solve the problems of just eating and, you know, surviving, that they really don't have room to really think about deeper, more complex needs and, you know, engineering feats and things to make society better?
Yeah, it's interesting. I just this morning read this really thought-provoking essay that makes the case sort of ultimately against social media for dragging us back into what the author calls the gossip trap. So the overall idea is that, you know, for most of human civilization, we lived in this in communities of 150 people or less. This is the sort of, this is Robin Dunbar's magic number. So people have pointed to 150 people as the maximum number of social connections that any individual human can really kind of keep in their mind at any given time. This is why it's the average number of Facebook friends people have, for example. And so we live for most of our ancestral history in groups of that size or smaller. And the idea in this essay is that if you're in a group that size or smaller, your social hierarchy is mostly, it's very much like high school. It's very much managed. Most of your energy is going toward reputational management. It's going to talking about people. It's going to gossip. And that keeps the sort of overall advancement of civilization or the advancement of just human behavior in general limited to that gossipy domain in that sphere. So it's only when you start to get in groups that are bigger than that, that you actually have to have some kind of institutional overlay that manages social hierarchies beyond just using gossip, beyond just, oh, well, that guy deserves to be in power and to make decisions because he's the best guy for the job. If you've got a couple thousand people, you start losing track of who that is. You need some sort of more bureaucratic mechanism to organize that. This is the argument. I'm not saying I'm totally on board with this argument, but this is what he lays out in this article. I just found it really, really interesting. And the idea being that as you start to build that up and as you start to have these more impersonal or rational legal, as Max Weber would call them, kind of superstructures on society, then you become capable of having more more civilizational advancements, as we tend to think of them. And so you're able to actually share ideas more broadly. You're able to have more insulation from those ideas within the social context. So you're able to take more risks with what you're putting out there and be more adventurous, et cetera, et cetera. So, and that social media, according to this author, has completely undone all of this and thrown us right back into the gossip trap, which is our natural evolved form of government. That's where we live, is in this kind of high school reputational management trap that just sucks all of our bandwidth and prevents us from doing anything more accomplished with our existence. So I think all of that can be true, and there is this sort of yearning to understand, you know, what it's all about and what are we doing here, and to tell stories about it that display sexual fitness for a certain percentage of people, and that has always been the case. But as far as, you know, making beautiful works of art and literature and building new legal systems and Western civilization and all of its trappings, you have to get outside of Dunbar's number to start building that sort of thing, because you need something more than just the institutional mechanism of gossip to govern yourselves.
And Dr. Lyle, since you so famously said on this show a couple of years ago that social media is the cigarette, or Facebook is the cigarette of the 21st century, what would you say to Dr. Hawker, to the person who wrote this article about the smartphones?
I don't know. It's too complicated for me. I'm done. On to the next question.
Okay, fair enough. All right. Our next question is, dear doctors, I'm just curious how this podcast came into being and the aim behind it, as it appears to be an extremely altruistic dissipation of scientifically accurate advice and help, and highly grateful for it. Thank you.
Yeah.
Wasn't it just you guys chit-chatting?
Yeah. Actually... Well, it's actually not particularly altruistic. It's all kinds of possible little ancillary payoffs along the way. This all started out with Nathan actually wanted to chit-chat with me about evolutionary psychology. He had been a staff doctor at True North and had come in and listened to my Saturday lectures for several years. And then he wanted to be able to ask questions and listen to me answer. And yet, you know, he was not going to pony up $150 an hour.
It's too cheap.
once a week to do this for an hour. And so so he came up with this idea. And I thought, you know, that's not a bad idea. Probably nothing comes of it, but I was just kind of, I think the world of podcasts had begun to happen, obviously, and I also, it also felt to me like I had spent, I'd been lecturing for, at that point, probably almost 20 years at True North every weekend. And so not to mention many years in the prisons where I was usually lecturing four or five times a week. So I had done a huge amount of conceptual development of how explaining, and not to mention all the years of psychotherapy. So I had an awful lot of knowledge about asking questions. And so all kinds of questions that people have. And so people at True North Health Center, I used to, you know, in the very early days, I would think about what I was going to lecture on. And people that know and that have been there know that Alan Goldhammer has given the same lecture for 35 years. Okay. he just does the same, just the same thing over and over again. Okay. My attitude was, first I started to try to write, you know, have a basically a talk that I had. And then finally I got, I was uninterested in giving the same talk over and over again, because it's new people. And so you're sort of starting from scratch. And so my attitude was, no, I just want to answer questions. And this is how I would wind up with questions to things that I would have never personally asked. And that made it interesting for me. So now I'm answering questions on the fly, which is infinitely more interesting than answering a question or giving a presentation that I already know everything about it, because I've already laid it out in advance. And so, and I used to think, you know, by 2016, it started to occur to me that it seemed like an incredible waste of my abilities to be answering these questions to 14 people in an audience who aren't even particularly necessarily interested in the topics anyway. Because remember, just because we're at True North doesn't mean that anybody's interested in man and the universe, for God's sakes. It's not like we've got a bunch of Aristotelian scholars hanging around there. So what they want is, you know, what can I eat? Is what's going to, you know, help my arthritis? It's like, this is not what I'm interested in. This is not who I am. I'm super interested in this thing called evolutionary psychology. Ooh, that sounds bad. What am I supposed to do with that? Okay, so the truth of the matter is that that was an audience, but it was not the ideal audience. And it was 15 people, 18 people, maybe 22 people. And I would feel like at the end of it, you know what? A whole lot of people should have listened to that. It should have been recorded. And so when Nathan pitched me on the idea, in the back of my mind, it's like, yeah, there should be the opportunity to record these questions and answers so that a lot more people could listen to them. Now, that was it. So the idea was, is that it's essentially me answering questions at True North Health Center felt like, was starting to feel like after 20 years, like it was a waste of time. That I had done too much synthesis and I had too much revolutionary material in psychology, that to just be feeding it to people who really weren't very interested in it anyway, because that they had no interest in that subject, that this was a total waste of my time. I had to get some kind of economies of scale on this. I had no idea what other good it might be out in the world, what good it might do me, but it is always a good idea, if you're a professional of any kind, to have people know what it is that you're capable of if they don't know what you're capable of. It's not very good to be, you know, an orthopedic surgeon if there's no sign on your door and nobody can find you. And so Beat Your Genes became a way for me to share this information with the world very inexpensively. I told Nathan, you do everything. I'm not doing anything. Okay, I'm not analyzing something. I'm not helping with the software. I'm not going to be debug this or debug. Forget it. Forget it. Forget it.
Just do what you do best, which is
I'm going to do. I'll show up. Yeah. You tell me what to call in, and I'm there, and I'm happy to answer questions. Okay, and so that's what happened. And so we chugged along for a while, and then incredibly, you know, we were very fortunate to have fate, you know, takes a hand and lands us Dr. Jen Hawk, and now, you know, now we are doing the same thing. And again, for us to be answering these questions, now we have, I don't know how many people, 8,000 people listen to per episode. That's so many people, I don't even know, you know, sort of what that looks like. That's quite an amphitheater. So that's flattering to know that there's 8,000 people out there, but it would be enormously gratifying for me to know that there were 80 people out there. If, in other words, instead of just one-on-one or just 15 people in a room that don't care about what this is, if there were 80 people out there that were very interested in listening and tuning in repetitively, I would feel like this wasn't a waste of time. All kinds of things come out of this. One of the things that comes out of it is that our fans sometimes write to me and Jen, and they educate us about things that we wouldn't have known. That's great. That's one of the main points of answering questions and sharing your information is to have other people correct you. I had a young lady write to me and say, gee, have you ever heard of Dr. Shan Geisinger and her thinking of the adaptation to free famine in anorexia? And the answer is no, never heard of her. Wow. What a cherry that was that dropped on my plate that day. So there's been many good questions. There have been many very bright people. There's been a lot of people that want to incorporate this way of thinking into their own psychotherapeutic kind of futures that they're planning, which is fabulous to hear. In other words, there's all kinds of good things that come of it. And this isn't altruistic. This is building a village and being part of it.
That's great. Yeah, it's been a long, fun journey, and especially now Dr. Hawk's involved, and we get to hear you guys wind out on a lot of different topics. So it's been a lot of fun.
All good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Awesome.
All right.
Dr. Lau, you were very nice to say it, but really, I was just too cheap to pay the the 100.
Fair enough.
So. And too proud to share like personal things. I had to cloak it with other people's.
Yeah, that's perfect, so. Nathan. That's exactly. Yeah, I have this friend. Perfect.
Yeah. Asking for a friend.
Yeah. All right. Let's see what else we got. Excellent.
All right, so our next question. Dear doctors, I'm 23 years old from a pretty conservative nation, and I feel like I've missed out on many life experiences and therefore do not want a kid, as I want the rest of my life completely for myself and for the pursuit of other achievements. Today's seemingly increasingly apocalyptic world, due to climate change and resource shortage, further kills my desire to bring forth a child. I feel it's the poorly lived childhood and early adult experiences that prevent me from wanting a kid. Would it be possible to understand the psychology behind it with respect to the fact that childhood experiences don't shape our desires? Why do some women not want kids?
Well, Jen, why don't you just have fun with it?
Yeah, well, this is one of those questions that I feel she answers her question in the way that she sets it up. So, you know, there's sort of this hand waving about the apocalyptic world and resource scarcity, et cetera. But you really say right away that you don't want a kid. You want the rest of your life completely for yourself and the pursuit of other achievements. It's right there in the question. So, you know, some women don't want kids because they're running a cost-benefit analysis on other things that they want to do with their lives, and those things are going to win the day over their so-called biological imperative or their biological clock. So plenty of women are in this situation for one reason or another. Either they just don't feel very maternal intrinsically. They've never been particularly interested in kids. They're not very attracted to the idea of having kids. Or because they're running a very active trade-off. They're thinking, hey, there's a lot of things that I want to do. Kids are awesome, and you know, I'll be a great aunt to my brother's kids, and I'll spend time with them with the family, but I don't want or particularly need, from my subjective perspective, kids of my own. I would rather travel the world. I would rather do these other things with my time and energy. So, you know, we get a couple thousand women together and we run them out on a continuum of where are you with respect to your desire for children and how you feel about motherhood and how you see yourself if you completely have control over this decision and what you're going to do with these, you know, 20 plus years of your life, you're going to find amazing amounts of individual variation. And women are in a position now to be able to act on that variation in a way that they historically have not been. They, for our entire ancestral history, are breeding machines and very little else. They are spending their entire lives pregnant. I've seen many different estimates of the average number of pregnancies that women went through, but it's, you know, somewhere between half a dozen and 15. And all of those babies are not necessarily surviving or coming to term, but women are spending most of their productive years pregnant or just recovering from a pregnancy or getting over the death of an infant. I mean, this is just an incredible process for women throughout history that just for the last couple of generations, women have not been subject to. So now that there is more opportunity, you're going to see more variation showing up. And so there's nothing pathological or there's nothing that would point us to trouble in your childhood to suggest that that's why you wouldn't want to have children. We just like we wouldn't look to trouble in your childhood to tell us something about the shade of eye color that you have. This is just who you are, and your true genetic preferences are expressing themselves more authentically in an environment of greater choice. And so you were influenced to some degree by childhood experiences, but not to the degree that they are going to completely rearrange your inherent preferences for something like this, just like they're not going to change your inherent preferences for anything in life. So that's my general take on that. I'm sure Doug has more to add as well.
Yeah, it's perfect. All good.
Would you expect if that is in the genes that maybe they didn't have a good childhood because the mom really didn't want kids but was somehow forced to have them somehow,
sure,
or got trapped into
there
it?
There could
so
be a
they're
definite
not really,
correlation
it's not the
there.
Childhood, it's just yep. that the genes... their mom didn't actually want them either.
Yeah, you always have to look at these things. Yeah. So, you know, this is the classic example is, oh, well, if you want your children to love learning and to go to college and to be lifelong learners, you need to read to them a lot while they're children. And so lo and behold, you know, when the children who had their parents read to them all the time when they're kids, they have higher levels of higher education attainment, et cetera. So it worked. Look, it worked. We read more to them. And so they went on to love learning and love reading as adults. But you're not controlling for the fact that those genes have been the parents who loved to read are the parents who are reading to their children who are and they're having children who also have the intrinsic genetic preference to read and to learn and to educate themselves for the rest of their lives. So you actually can't make a valid inference about that process until you control for that, which they do in the twin studies, among many, many other things that they're looking at. Every single trait that you can shake a stick at in one twin study or another, there's 15 million pairs of twins that have been subjected to everything that you can operationalize. And this is what Robert Plowman writes about in Blueprint, which is a book we've talked about many times on the podcast. If people haven't heard us talk about it or are interested in this topic, it's very worth reading to get a sense of the so-called nature-nurture debate and why nurture is absolutely secondary to nature, by putting it gently, understatement of the year. And so until you control for the genes, you can't make any of these inferences. They're meaningless. And once you do control for the genes, you see that genes are really telling the tale almost all of the time, to a very high degree. So your desire for not wanting kids, there is some piece of your childhood environment in there. It's not entirely 1,000% genetic, but a lot of what we would classically call environmental, as Nate is pointing out, i.e. your mom didn't really want you. She didn't really want kids. And
just like that.
But people would typically say that that's an environmental factor, like, right. Oh, I grew up as an unwanted child in an unwanted home. But it's not an environmental factor because it's all
well, who created the environment? The genes, right?
With the fact that exactly this environment is not accidental. It's coming from a mother who had this, you know, genetic non-preference for kids. So you have to really it becomes a very complex story when you start to open your eyes to that, and you can see how many things that we think of as environmental factors really are genetic factors at the end of the day.
Yeah, it feels like a lot of bias in those things where they're like, oh, yeah, if you read to your kids, they'll become better readers. It's like, why not apply the opposite? Like, if you read to your kids, the parents will become better readers. You know, I mean, it's just kind of pushing the
So. Right. Well, yeah, we're not concerned about improving their situation in life. We just want the children to be little blank slates that are recipients of a lot of time and energy and the childhood industrial complex monetary instrument.
Yeah. Pretty soon, child's books are going to say, if you have your parents read to you, they'll think that you're going to be a better reader.
So. Well, that might be true.
All right. What else we got?
All right. Dear doctors, our next question. Dear doctors, it's been mentioned many times that our previous experiences don't have any effect on the structure of our personality and the etiopathogenesis of depression. So the real question, this question goes into a long kind of drawn out explanation about the inner sociometer, self-esteem, things like that. But really, the heart of the question is, does having bad childhood experiences cause depression?
No. No, your emotional life is a stream of reactions as a result of the calculations of cost-benefit analysis of your current situation. It couldn't be anything else. The attitude that some unpleasant childhood would influence what's going on at 35 years old is the equivalent of, I was really cold because I went and spent a weekend with my friends in Lake Arrowhead one December, and and I didn't have a very nice jacket on because I didn't anticipate it was going to be that cold, and I lost my gloves and my hands got really, really cold in the snow. That's why I am cold now. Of course not. You live in West Palm Beach now. Your hands are not cold anymore. Your people are thinking that emotional processes are somehow permanent or they're embossed inside of a nervous system. Emotional processes are inherently dynamic. Just as your hunger and thirst and fatigue and fever and your broken leg is dynamic, etc. In other words, it couldn't be any other way because the very purpose of feelings is to orient you towards what your situation is with respect to survival and reproductive outcomes. So depression, I'm depressed now because of my bad childhood. Of course you are not depressed now because of your bad childhood. Your bad childhood, only to the extent that something bad in your childhood is actively disturbing your situation today, and I don't know what that would be. You know, what could be reaching across 25 years? Oh, well, my dad didn't support my career, and, you know, therefore I'm working in this shitty job now, okay? Well, that doesn't influence what your decisions are in the current context. Your decisions, your nervous system basically analyzes trillions of data bits per second in order to calculate what you should be doing in the next instant. Okay? So think about my cat. My cat, you know, was once in a fight. And that cat, you know, got pretty sick. He went out there and he got a little bold and somebody stuck a claw in his stomach. And he was in pretty shitty shape there for a while. Okay? Well, he's not now. So when I go outside and I pick that cat up, he just purrs and he's just happy as a clam. Why? Because that's reflective of his current situation. Well, what was he then? He was depressed and miserable and struggling for his life, and we're all worried about him. Why? Because those were his circumstances then. So your job, the job of every animal brain, is to take the situation that you are in, all data in. And the system does not say, oh, well, I'll tell you what let's do. Let's go back and think about why we're in the kind of the shitty situation we're in. And let's just lament about how freaking unfair that all was. And let's just sit and stew in how much it would have been better had other people treated me better back 20 years ago. No, that is not how the system is designed at all. You can imagine, I mean, if you think that that's true, that you must have belonged to a family that was steeped in Freudian tradition, but you sure as hell weren't some hunter-gatherer, because any hunter-gatherer would roll their eyes and laugh. Be like, you got to be kidding me. You got some food to go get, chief. Your kids are going to starve to death. Don't be talking to me about how your old man was tough on you 25 years ago. Are you kidding me? You got pressing concerns right this second. Where do you get off even wasting my time with that conversation? It's a ludicrous conversation, okay? And, you know, we have more to say about that in our upcoming book that is, of course, imminent.
Yeah, any minute now.
But you can see, like, in this culture, at this day and age, what an extraordinary sack of shit and an unbelievable amount of indulgence and self-pitying and leveraging and complaining is going on to try to get resources from people who've had unpleasant childhood experiences or other unpleasant past experiences. Okay, so let's get straight. Any hunter-gatherer would laugh their asses off at any of this kind of talk. The truth of the matter is that you, like every other animal, you take your given circumstances as a given. You calculate based on what your talents, abilities, resources, and needs are, and all of the options that you have in front of you. And your job is to run 2+ trillion calculations a second to try to figure out what you are doing in the next second. That is an extremely dynamic picture. And to think that if you are depressed today, that the reason for that depression is anything other than the set of circumstances that you are right now attempting to optimize, and you must be failing or you wouldn't be getting the negative feedback of the depression. You are not measuring your situation about what it is that your calculations come up with, and they say, okay, what you should be doing is XYZ. When you do XYZ and you get failure feedback because it didn't work as well as we thought it was going to work, then you're going to experience a mood shift to the negative. That's a signaling device to tell you that the outcomes were not as computed. What you don't do is you don't say, I know what we're going to do with this big brain and its 2 trillion calculations per second capability. We're going to go back in time and reanalyze how shitty we have it. And as a result of what? No way. There's no way that would be the architecture of the mind of any animal. That would be an evolutionary disaster for that to be the case. No, we are going to find out that the individual is depressed today specifically because when their brain calculates what is in their best interest and what is the best behavioral trajectory for them to improve their ability literally in the next 5 minutes, with respect to their survival and reproductive capabilities, it turns out that when they begin to take actions in a sequence that will cause them to increase their position of power with respect to survival and reproductive problems, then they are getting surprisingly negative feedback as a result. The nature of depression is no different than looking at a 9-year-old boy staring at a math problem, and he's being instructed and he's struggling with it, and he sort of gets one right, and his mom is happy, and he's happy, but he's uncertain. And then when he tries the next one, he fails, and now his mom says, no, that's not right, and now he feels depressed. There's no difference between major depressive disorder and that incident that is right in front of that child in that 15 seconds. It is the same process exactly. So we can see that he's going to get happy when he actually grasps the underlying principle and his brain actually calculates, got it, now I understand what on earth they were talking about. And it gets the next one right, and now it's excited. It's like, oh, give me the next one. I think I understand. And then it gets another one right, and then it gets another one right, and now it's beaming. There you go. The end of the depression. Okay? So that is the causes of depression are actually extremely straightforward conceptually. Depression is a failure feedback mechanism for sub-goal, a lack of sub-goal achievement that is surprising the person with respect to what it is that they thought their successes were going to be based on the time and energy that they expended on the sub goal. That's it. Okay? As it should be, people. This is depression and elation work exactly as they should work. And so the idea that the, quote, roots of somebody's current depression are in anything that was taking place a year ago, 2 years ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 25 years ago, 38 years ago is ludicrous. All right. That's all I have to say about that.
Oh, Dr. Lau, I love it when you wind up.
Yeah, that's great. That's perfect. Perfect example.
Yeah. Excellent. All right. Well, our final question, dear doctors, maybe two more depending on how long this one goes, but dear doctors, whose philosopher's view of the world do you agree with the most? What does Dr. Lyle think of the view of ancient Greek atomists?
You know, when it comes to great scholarly stuff, I am no scholar. We have, thank goodness, a resident scholar. So I'm going to turn that over to the Harvard PhD.
Yeah, just in time for lots of dog background noise. I mean, it's interesting. I have a first of all, a very broad sort of category of who I consider a philosopher. So I think a lot of people would fall under that umbrella, including lots of people that you would put in this category, Doug. So I think once the conversation is underway, you could find a lot of philosophical influence yourself. Mm-hmm. And I would say that my answer to this question has changed quite a bit in the last, 2.5 years or so, where I have come to value some political philosophers and political theorists and giants in literature who really value or very concerned with protecting individual rights against the mob. Mm-hmm. That's been sort of my, you know, the people I am rereading and reappreciating are the people who are most concerned with that question, which is an ever-present question throughout political theory going back forever. This is kind of, how do you balance this problem? How do you accomplish something that looks like an aggregation of popular interest and popular representation, and that doesn't suppress interests of minority populations or minority views, but that also doesn't have a tyranny of the minority or the majority. How do you balance all these things? So, you know, Thomas Hobbes, Edmund Burke, James Madison. these are the guys that, and they are mostly guys that I find myself turning to in these tumultuous times. Reading a lot of Dostoevsky, reappreciating Samuel Huntington, who's a more modern political theorist who wrote The Clash of Civilizations, which was the book that we loved to hate as an undergrad in political science and also in grad school. But I have a real renewed appreciation for the realistic view of human nature and of the trade-offs present in trying to negotiate popular interest with individual liberty.
Yeah, all good. Yeah, I don't care. Couldn't care less about some, you know, a Greek, atomicists or whatever. Yeah, it is. Like, these are, somebody's reaching pretty far for about some, you know, fancy question. I'm going to second exactly what Jen is talking about. I think on our 100th podcast many years ago, somebody asked me what's the most important thing, or what, you know, if they made me world czar, you know, what's the most important thing to me? And I said then, human freedom. And I said, I believe I said more about this as I remember, that as long as human beings are free, human beings can solve the problems of human life. But if human beings are not free, then we're in trouble. And I stand by that today. And we are, you know, we certainly have major problems today, not because the problems are insurmountable at all. It's because human freedoms are under tremendous assault from individuals who would like to seize control and to operate the world top down. And so that is by far the greatest threat to humanity. And the desire for power and control is an endemic and really nasty feature of human nature. And so, you know, no wonder Jen, as a political scientist, you know, understands, you know, knowing far more about history than the rest of us and of political systems, et cetera. We know, we can appreciate, some of us, how extraordinarily rare the day in the sun has been for the last, you know, couple hundred years in Western democracies. And now we're seeing how fragile it is. And so the philosophers have certainly been worried about this, but I think the wisest of them have been the ones that have been the most worried about this very possibility, because this is the lack of human trust in their fellow humans and the willingness to let other people have different views than ourselves and has us decide on a free self-governing basis about what the decisions are going to be. These are the things that are currently under assault, and if it's not protected, you know, then the world is going to head towards an increasingly dark place.
Yep. Wow. Well,
don't despair. They're in for a hell of a fight. Okay, because yeah. There's an awful lot of people that understand this and that are heavily invested in the process of protecting human freedom. So we will watch the next few years, you know, with our eyes wide open, paying very close attention to what these trends look like. This is why Jen, you know, created her political science, you know, chat that I do with her, and we think about these things, and so that's an interesting place for people to go if they're interested at all. But we don't have any solutions. All we have is observations and thinking. But certainly when it comes to the question of, you know, what philosophers, i.e. the people that we're going to admire most are the people who are razor sharp thinking deeply about this problem. Okay. That is,
there's been a lot of them.
Yes. Absolutely.
Yeah. Not a new problem by any means.
Yeah. I would add one that's going to make Jen shiver, and that is
I thought so.
if you actually go back and look at some of her writings, they are very, very interesting. So
who?
Ayn Rand.
Oh,
yeah. Actually, her name is Ayn.
Yes, that's the correct pronunciation, yes. But that's not how she's usually known. So I wasn't going to be pedantic about it.
Perfect.
But that's okay. You can.
Of course. No, you're doing it exactly right. For example, one of her works is called "Capitalism: The Unknown Ideal," and that was very carefully described set of essays, i.e., capitalism is the unknown ideal. People do not actually understand it. And they do not understand its miraculous and spectacular nature. And those that I've run into who have acted like they knew something will start talking about the failures of capitalism, and they don't understand capitalism. So another work was called The New Left, The Anti-Industrial Revolution. Interesting that she's writing these things in the 1960s, 50 years later. That's what modern day Europe is now finding out, as the president of France is telling his people that the age of abundance is over, and that the people in Switzerland are being told that if you turn up your thermostat over 66.2 degrees Fahrenheit this winter, we could throw you in jail for 3 years.
And that the needs of Ukrainians are more important than the needs of European constituents.
That's correct. You're looking at the new left, the anti-industrial revolution. Okay, and so this is why Rand, despite her very, very rough edges, will always have a place in my heart as somebody who was willing to look clearly and call a spade when it was appropriate. And so that's one of the philosophers that I admire.
Dr. Lyle, I remember a couple years ago, in the beginning of the podcast, maybe it was episode 100, maybe it was episode 200, but I think you were asked, who would you have dinner with who's not alive currently? And I think maybe your answer was Aristotle, or you would have a conversation mm-hmm. with Aristotle.
Certainly. Yeah, that's just because that's such an extraordinary intellect. If you you would be talking to someone who is so unlike, you know, a lot of people that you would talk to today, you would have a lot of a background that could overlap with them. And it would be fantastic to talk to a lot of the great thinkers of the last 100 years. But to be able to go back a couple of thousand years and to get inside for a while that mind and just watch it wind out, I think that would be, obviously we're just entertaining ourselves, but that would be an extraordinary experience, you know, quite unlike anything else.
Wonderful.
All right. What All else right. we got? Well, we got one more, Nathan?
Yeah, let's do one more.
Oh, I can't. I gotta go.
You gotta go.
That dog's going absolutely insane. Yeah. I'm sorry.
Gotcha.
Dr. Fantastic. Hawkins, thank you so much. Really appreciate it, as always.
Thanks, Nathan. Thanks, Jen.
Guys, have a good night.
Gotcha. Bye.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G., Dr. Lyle, and Dr. Hawk with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.